You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 262 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carestino.
And I'm coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Redden, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we are joined this week by the listener's favorite, the beloved, the famous Cousin Katie is back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so long.
Indeed, it has entirely too long. Well, we only have one toast this week, and that's to Katie as the third time Pelton Cast MVP. But we are going to be toasting with the Fremont Ollie IPA, which is the latest in their rotating IPA series, which is named after and in honor of the pets of Fremont. Ollie appears to be a very good dog, down and dirty. Details here, two row pale and Vienna malts with rolled oats and Citra, Simcoe, Chinook, and I seem to have dropped the last hop here. The flavor is moderately sweet and bitter. Both linger subtly in medium body that's mildly warming and mouth watering.
Love is that's a four-legged bird.
That love.
Well, congrats, Katie. You've done it again. I just don't imagine a scenario where you're on the ballot and you don't win in the future.
No, I was thinking that I should thank all of my supporter for voting for me again. It's such a thrill, but I wanted to pull a Ving Rhames. I'm sure you remember in 1998 how he called Don Lemon up. Not Don Lemon, god damn it.
I'm so fascinated where this is going.
What is his name? The old lemon. What is his name? You know, grumpier old men.
Oh, Jack Lemon. Yes.
Jack Liz Lemon.
There we go. Whatever. Anyways, he called him up on stage and he said, I want to share my Golden Globe or Emmy or one of those with you because I think it should have been yours. And so I think that it would only be right to share this honor with someone who brings it every week for the podcast. Someone who's, you know, puts in all that time, just an extraordinary amount of time every week. They're just dedicated to the cause. And that I'm going to call right up right now to share this with me. And that is going to be an awkwardly long pause.
Oh, no. Wow, awkwardly long pause. Love to be here tonight. Very excited to be here.
You're the real MVP. Right. Yeah.
Wow, well done.
I was really upset that didn't make the top voting. So,
There may have been some strategic voting from multiple accounts by me to prevent that. That may or may not have happened.
Wait, are you serious?
It's fixed.
I am serious, yes.
The whole ballot is fixed.
I have a lot of different accounts, as you know.
Wow. Did you vote for yourself?
No, accounts? I actually did not vote for myself even in the final ballot, but these were the polls to determine the last finalist. So I was voting for Let's Remember Some Years, which did in fact come in second in the voting. So I thought it was a reasonable choice.
Let's Remember Some Years was only in a handful of podcasts. Awkward silence is sprinkled throughout all of the Pelton Cast.
In terms of volume, it's tough to top. That's for sure.
I don't think this was ever a thing before we started having to do Zoom podcasts. I feel like it's gotten like much more prominent in the post-Zoom era.
The thing is, I think a lot of people think I don't edit these podcasts, that I just slap them up immediately after we're done. And that's not true. I'm doing a shit ton of editing and still there's all these awkward pauses. So think about what it must sound like when we're recording it.
You think that's more of a compliment to yourself than it is?
Oh, no, I don't think that at all. It's a defense of myself in some one limited way. Oh, boy.
Awkwardly long pause is the real MVP of the heavily edited Pelton Cast.
Are you ever editing in the pauses? Does that happen?
You know, look, you can't fake awkwardness like that. That has to be all natural.
Anyway, you people got what you wanted. Katie has her third MVP. It's really impressive here.
She's right up there with like Jordan, you know, Russell, Kareem, all these one named NBA stars. There was the whole thing this year about we can't vote Giannis an MVP a third time because he's not as good as those players, which he wasn't deserving of the MVP anyway. But Katie, she just sailed right on through for the third MVP. Never a question.
I was scared, very scared.
Why were you scared?
Well, the competition. It was tough this year.
What was the competition? The concept of remembering things.
Yeah.
Two of the three other choices are static from year to year. Now, Tristan did, as we discussed last week, wage a PR campaign on his own behalf. He was putting up billboards.
If recording this podcast is a PR campaign, that's like saying fucking LeBron James is waging a PR. Did he wage a PR campaign by hitting that game-winning shot tonight?
No,
a PR campaign.
He waged a PR campaign by telling everyone that he couldn't was seeing three baskets. That was the PR campaign.
Can't see, bro. That's me.
And quite a PR campaign. Facts. It was.
Facts. Anyway, I was remembering, in honor of the real MVP, remembering some years, I was remembering some of Katie's greatest appearances from this year, which I'd forgotten about. But then I was thinking back to, was this around Apple Cup time that Katie had, I believe, two consecutive legendary Bob Wine appearances. I think
Around then probably, yes. I mean, I don't know what time the Apple Cup was supposed to be played this year anymore because college football was so weird, but it was around Christmas time that there was Bob Wine. And we talked about Christmas songs, of course.
So that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no recollection of Bob Wine appearances, but...
Well, the Bob Wine will do that to you. Yeah.
I don't know if the listener knows this. I might have already mentioned this, but Bob has actually, you know, started making his own wine and allowed me to sample it the last time I went over there. And so you will actually probably in the near future be finding Bob Wine at stores near you or just your basement or, you know.
Katie's house.
Yeah, my house. So exciting.
Tristan sounded surprised when I told him that Bob made his own wine. He did not seem to understand that. Or to know that, I should
say. Skeptical.
They're not just for looks.
Sampled some Bob Wine in the past, but I think the scale of the production is ramping up.
Yes. There's a lot of bottles, a lot of jugs, a lot of things for the wine.
At Carcino Vineyards.
Or Carcino Cellars. I'm not sure which one.
I think Cellars is a lot better.
Yeah, I like Cellars. So, anyway,
some of the materials with which he's making wine come from the house in which I'm living, which has been in our family for multiple generations. And there was just, they used to make a lot of wine, and there was some of the stuff was left over. And a few years ago, he took it back to the Tri-Cities.
He took the grape crusher from you?
Yep. I mean, not that I was doing anything with it.
Grape crusher?
You're just crushing those grapes every day.
There were zero grapes crushed here. I'm afraid.
Is he using that particular grape crusher in his?
I think so, but I'm not sure. I was concerned of whether or not it was properly cleaned.
I will not be consuming this wine.
I drank it. And
she's still here.
Yeah.
She's still every day.
I apparently drank two or three glasses of it, which I thought was, you know, that's a statement. So my problem is I don't actually know what good wine tastes like. So I feel like I don't want to like be like, oh, it's so good. And then he goes and, you know, puts, you know, all of, you know, his resources towards launching this wine campaign. And it's all based on me saying it's good. And it's actually terrible because I don't know what good wine is. So
what is the likelihood of that happening?
Bob putting all of his resources behind a wine campaign because Katie said it was good.
I don't know. It's very.
She's like three-time podcast MVP, so have to do something right here.
Oh man, if it's MVP is the brand name, perhaps
What are you drink? Did you go to Costco earlier? What are you drinking?
No, I went to a mom and pop ice cream place in North Bend.
Living that Vax life.
No, I didn't go. No, I.
Okay.
Got it to go.
Okay.
Why were you in North Bend?
I took Ella to the little park there that you can ride bikes on a hill. Oh man, I saw some youth playing baseball, so I have some thoughts for your Coach's Corner.
Well, we're going to have a special guest for Coach's Corner this week.
Oh, great.
It's going to be four Caracinos on the call. That is a new record, I think.
It's going to be three Caracinos and ESPN's Kevin Pelton on the call.
It's my middle name. It's still in my name, okay?
Is a special guest going to be someone who might be offended if I talk poorly about the pitching ability of nine-year-olds?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm sure that she'll be talking about the pitching ability of nine-year-olds.
That's what she's coming on for. Well, instead of wine, which at some point our beer of the week surely will be Bob Wine, if it's actually available, let's talk about food. And specifically, let's talk about two great tastes that apparently now go great together, which is our sponsors, Pagliacci Pizza, and Friends of the Pod, Lil Woody's, coming together to make two different collaborative items this week. Incredible. And how were we not notified of this beforehand?
Not even notified. How were we not invited to participate?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. How would you participate?
In the taste testing?
We just slap our name on there.
I mean, look, if you think of Pagliacci and Lil Woody's like coming together, hopefully you think of the Pelton cast.
The fraction of people who are thinking about Pagliacci and Lil Woody's and also think of the Pelton cast.
That's what I'm saying is if you're thinking of them together, you're probably already thinking of the Pelton cast by definition.
Honestly, when you said it, I was thinking how. I wasn't thinking Pelton cast. I was thinking how can you do that together?
Well, so they have ruled out first Lil Woody's drop.
Well. Literally no other answer, just well, and we moved on.
Well.
Might have been a good place for an awkward silence. One in later. Get at it that in post.
You can't fake those awkward silences. Those have to be 100%. They're artisanal. They're handcrafted, those awkward silences. Purpose built. So on Tuesday is Lil Woody's Burger of the Week. They dropped the Pagliacci Grand Salami Burger featuring the ingredients from the Grand Salami Primo at Pagliacci. You've got pepperoni on there. You've got salami, Canadian bacon, obviously the traditional burger patty, mozzarella. And then on top of that, a dipping cup of marinara sauce to go with your burger, which was something I had never experienced before. Marinara sauce with a burger. That was light years ahead, I guess I would say, on their part. So all of us had this for lunch today. What's the review?
I thought it was like shockingly good. Because again, when I heard the two names together, I was confused as to how it would work together. But it's almost like the hamburger patty was just not there. And you were just eating like a sub sandwich, like a Italian BMT or something from Subway. And it was pretty good if you look at it like that.
I mean, I wouldn't say the burger patty wasn't there. I think it certainly added to the flavor as well. But the concern you'd have is that those kind of compete with each other. And I wouldn't say that was right. The case here. They melded together.
Yeah, you didn't notice. It wasn't too much like you felt like you were eating two wildly different things. It just kind of, I would say the burger was a little bit hidden.
It wasn't the forward flavor.
Yeah.
Saying that something tastes like Subway and is also good, that is a positive comparison.
Whoa, who here raved about going to Subway last week?
I went to Subway for like the first time in 5 years.
I don't dislike Subway, and I don't dislike any sandwich that has like salami and other like, you know, pepperoni type meats on it. I also said I like Totino's pizza, so there's just...
Yeah, the spicy Italian, right? The pepperoni and salami, and then the BMT has ham. Is that my correct recollection there?
Whatever Ben gets, I eat.
So Tristan did not partake in the marinara.
I didn't know that the marinara was there.
I also thought there.
Yeah, very few people ate the marinara.
There was four things of marinara, and I was like, this is way too much sauce. One of it was Tristan's. And
two of them were Tristan's.
Ben used like a little bit of his, and I was like, I'm just not gonna do this.
I don't think I need marinara on a burger. The burger was good on its own.
So Ben, it seems like he just put the sauce on the burger, right?
Yeah, I think he just dunked it on there.
Whereas I dunked it in sauce, which is, I think what they're intending is that they came as a side. It was like, you know, putting your grilled cheese in tomato soup or something like that, I guess, is the equivalent.
No, I think he poured it on. So he had a different experience.
And I mean, I don't think it needed that. It held up on it fine as a, you know, perfectly well as a burger on its own. But the marinara was a surprisingly strong addition. It was not something I had ever thought about doing, was burger and marinara, but it worked out. So also, I hadn't had the Little Woody's queso in a long time. I decided to do that, which is a staple of your order usually, and it is better than I remembered.
Gotta get the queso.
Yeah, the queso is very strong. So coming Thursday is going to be the Big Woody Primo at Pagliacci as one of their special pizzas for a limited time. I think a little more than the week that the Little Woody's Burger of the Week will be on with the Grand Salami Burr. But that's definitely going to be worth checking out, and we'll have a review of that on next week's pod.
All right.
It's exciting.
So this week, we're not going to have a review in our search for Seattle's best fried chicken because the NBA schedule did not work out the way that we thought it when we were recording last week. Instead, there were games at...
I like that you say we as if I had like some perspective about the NBA schedule.
It's the royal we. So Sunday night, there were in fact games when it sounded like they were going to play them all during the day. And I could not have missed that epic tank off between the Clippers and the Oklahoma City Thunder on Sunday. Those Daniel Oturu post-ups late in the game were not going to watch themselves. So we did not have June Baby's Holy Sunday Fried Chicken Dinner. But we did. I put together that I was driving back on Saturday from the Storm season opener in Everett, which we'll talk about later in the pod, and put together that on my drive back, it would be fairly convenient to just stop off at June Baby and pick up some a la carte orders from there. And so Tristan and I split the fried chicken sandwich and the pulled pork sandwich from June Baby. And then Mrs. Fantasy Genius also had the pulled pork sandwich. So let's get some thoughts on those before we do our eventual June Baby fried chicken review.
They were great.
Yes. Unsurprisingly. I mean,
I cheated and ate all the carbs for those rolls.
Wow. And well worth it. Those were terrific rolls. I mean, I said this when we had takeout from, which was like cook at home during the deep quarantine from June Baby. There's an ability there to make even things I don't normally like taste good. So then when you apply that to the fried chicken and pulled pork, it's going to taste very good.
The buns though, I mean, just, oh my God. I kind of can't even believe it, but the chicken sandwich, it was good, but we're judging on like a pretty severe scale here, right? And this is in competition with something like the Mahono chicken sandwich. There are a lot of very good chicken sandwiches out there. It's in conversation with them, but it definitely wasn't like, didn't have the chicken sandwich and say to myself, this is the best chicken sandwich I've ever had in my entire life.
I would agree with that. I didn't think it was the better of the two sandwiches. I liked the pulled pork better. Of the two. And I mean, the thing is, these are very reasonable values as compared to the cost of like a full dinner from, you know, multi-course dinner from June Baby. It's like $14 for the pulled pork sandwich, $16 for the chicken sandwich. And that comes with those and fingerling potatoes, which you,
oh my God.
Yeah, they were very good, which you made a pun about while you were eating them with your fingers.
Usually that's you who does that.
it was a very surprising twist in the Fountain cast. But yeah, I mean, just
it was so a low flavorful.
Oh, I don't know about that. So flavorful, delicious. We also got the buns to split, and those are outstanding, just tremendous.
I can also report that we were with Jan when we got this, and Jan still found the whole thing to be too expensive.
Oh, of course she did.
She did steal a bun.
Of course, I refused to divulge the cost of the buns to her because I knew it was just going to...
Oh, gonna, how much was, are they? They're not that much.
I mean, it's $2 a piece for them. So, now again, this is by Jan definition, not our definition.
What you should not divulge is the price of this Sunday chicken dinner.
I did not plan to. Under no scenario did I plan to do that. So
She might collapse and die if she found out what the chicken dinner costs.
I just don't want to talk about the chicken sandwich too much because I feel like it could bleed into the conversation about the fried chicken dinner. I mean, obviously they're different things, but
that's a good point. Plus, we have more important things to get to.
Is that Coach's Corner? The triumphant return?
So, for the first time in history, I did not coach a child's sporting event.
Wow.
Literally the first time that I've been to a child's sporting event and didn't coach at all in any capacity since, I don't know, 2017. It's been a very long time. However, coaching at that game was Mrs. Fantasy Genius. This time she lost the argument and had to coach. So we have a special guest for Coach's Corner, one of the three Carcinos on this podcast right now, and ESPN's Kevin Pelton.
It's Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I couldn't let this Coach's Corner go by this week. It was just too good. Had to share.
Like the Mariners with a pitch, you couldn't just let it go by.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So tell us about what happened.
So this week I was bench coaching for Baby Fantasy Genius. That's his moniker here. Yes. Yes.
I Luca. Think we've kind of given that up.
Okay. Luca, the 10U baseball player here. And we were out in Roniesville again. And it was the second day after the mask mandate had been lifted by the CDC.
Oh, Lord.
So out we go. Deeper and deeper and deeper. Into red country.
The mask mandate has only been lifted in places where they already were not wearing masks.
Well,
let me tell you, our team was the only team wearing any sort of facial covering. Anybody on any of the other teams that may have been adhering to general guidelines of, you know, common courtesy, there were noses and mouths flying everywhere, droplets everywhere. So our team was a little island of masks in a sea of noses.
How many teams were there?
Oh gosh, that place is just like, it's, I don't know if I can swear.
Because they've got, yes.
It's a shit show out there. There's like 8 fields or something. There's like 16 teams. There's like all the way from like 18-year-old high school kids all the way down to T-ball. It's like, it's nuts. And everybody and their auntie and their grandma and their cousin is watching. Like, there's overflow parking. It is intense. It's, like, more people than I've been around since, like, what, February of 2019? Like, February of 2020.
Yeah, hopefully not since February of 2019. No. Hopefully you've been around some people since
then. I don't
think
I'd be mad about that, but yeah. No, it's intense. But anyways, we're the only masked little group from our area. And we get there. We're warming up. We're ready to roll. And then before the game, the coaches always go out and talk with the umpire. You know, they try to shake hands. Our coach always sort of, you know, does like a elbow bump or something awkwardly.
You got to talk about the ground rules.
Yeah, exactly. And we're ready. We're going to be on the field first. We have our lineup ready to go. I'm in the dugout. Guess what? Coach runs back to the dugout. First time ever, we're going to be playing with a live ball. Stealing is allowed. Pass balls are allowed. We have never practiced this. We have no idea what we're doing, but we're going to run with it. So really quick, we change up the lineup to get what we have. One player that knows what he's doing. Everybody else is just completely clueless. No offense to Luca. Luca is not the one player that knows what he's doing. So put that player at shortstop. Coach pulls him aside and says, you're in charge out there. You got to tell everybody what they're doing. You got to tell everybody what to do if the runner's running. It's on you, Luke. Let's do this. I was like, oh, poor Luke. Okay, so we go. It's intense. Basically, everyone steals on every single at bat because there's
kids trying to throw it. Yeah, like
Yeah. So there's a pitch, the catcher can't catch it, and we advance. So we walk and steal. Thankfully, we did agree to keep the mercy rule. So five run rule is still there. But I must say it was quite a rude awakening. Part of, I think, the reason that the sheer terror is in the eyes of our lovely players is that the other team, because like I think Tristan said, explained, the other league that we're playing against has actual sponsors. This week is they're wearing black on black jerseys and pants. Sponsors, B&E Concrete. I mean, we can't win, right? Like, it reminded me of Ballard. What was Ballard Steel?
Ballard Sheet Metal.
Yeah, it was basically the same deal. I was like, it's not gonna happen. There's a live ball. We can steal, and we're with B&E Concrete, maskless noses flying everywhere. Like, we have no chance. Anyways, but one thing I thought I might be able to best them at is bench coaching. So I played softball. What? I have my skills. I know what they are. They're minimal, but I know what they are. So I played softball.
The search for a competitive edge.
Right. You always got to try. I played softball through late elementary, middle school. I got through freshman year of high school and realized, Jesus Christ, these women are large. This is just, it's not going to happen for me. I remember my friend Colleen pulling me aside and being like, you know, great effort out there. Maybe you should go back to get Parks and Rec. I was like, totally. I'm going to join the I joined the dance team. I joined the fucking dance team.
That's so, the Kevin Pelton League, Kent Parks and Rec.
That's the official Pelton League. There was multiple Peltons on our team.
That's where he stood in there and took one for the team.
took two for the team.
Like Doyle or whatever.
that was the appropriate level of play for me, for sure.
Me as well, right? But aside from that, I have some experience with softball. And the main difference that I've noticed with having three boys playing baseball and myself with softball is the level of cheering that happens. So softball, we have coordinated cheers, we have stomps, we have claps, we have, I mean, everything. We have, it's like fucking cheerleading here. We have everything all written down. We have somebody calling the cheers, we're standing up, we're slapping, we're jumping. It's great. It's like stomp the yard. It's amazing. However, baseball, they're just like so stoic. They just sit there and they occasionally they're like, good job, bro. I'm like, oh, come on, guys. So I think,
you know, I think a good team has a lot of chatter. Sonic Softball, our team had a lot of chatter.
Perhaps we just haven't gotten it. I haven't seen it in baseball, but I try to bring that when I bench. I try and get them going. We try to, like, you know, I try to rile up the boys. One girl, we try to go. So when I see the other bench coach from B&E Construction, B&E Concrete. He's like, okay, so he looks like maybe he came from like NorCal in like maybe 1998. He's got like the tall black socks. He's got a pocket chain. He's, you know, got a shaved head. He's got full sleeve tattoos, black on black everything.
I'm like, Sublime is playing behind him.
Totally, all the time. He has like a theme song. I'm like, okay, I got this. I'm going to best him at bench coaching. Second inning, their team's up to bat. Or bottom of the first. Team's up to bat. He has choreographed cheers.
Wow.
They're stomping. Wow. They're clapping. They're rooting. There's even woo woo and turning around and like booty shaking. I'm done, dude. Like, it was over. So,
I mean, it sounds like you've got a mission for what to do at practice this week.
Yeah. I mean, yes, if I can get them on board. But anyway, that was about it. That's when I knew it was over. But all in all, I guess it was fine. Sunny day. And like you said, I've got some goals now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always important to have goals, I think.
This took such a different turn from what I was expecting. I was expecting it to be about Luca pitching and being so animated on the mound and complaining at the umpire, young Tristan style, maybe even current Tristan style, that he ended up not getting proper balls and strikes called for him because the umpire was mad at him.
This also did happen. So
Draymond Green did?
Yes. As we just as I think Tristan told y'all last week or the week before or whatever, Luca with the Mutombo issue. So those commercials that are on with Mutombo in the grocery store, not today.
Geico.
So
yeah.
This has really made an impression on him. So he has started doing that during games if he feels that something was not called correctly. So yes, Tristan's right. He was pitching. And pitch that looked from where I was standing pretty good, called a ball. He threw a full-on tantrum. And I do not know where this comes from. It is not Carcino. It is sure as hell not McDaniels. Like, it's probably my dad. Maybe it's Tristan. I don't know. Like, stomping, arms in the air, like Italian gesturing all over the place. And I was like, oh my God, Luca. Oh my God, Luca. Oh my God, Luca. And so the umpire like calls him over and is like, mm-mm-mm. And then of course the next like six pitches that look fine to me, the coach, everyone else watching, outside, air quotes, wow. Outside. Yeah. So I had to like pull him aside and have a talk with him about like, if you're an asshole, they're going to determine that the strike zone is a lot smaller than if you are a normal human being. And so we made a system. If he felt like Mutomboing, if that finger started coming up, he wanted to wag it, we were just going to look right at each other. And I was going to do the eyes that Katie taught me, the Katie to Ella eyes. But I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, and that's it. We're not going to do anything at the umpire, and that finger is going to stay in the glove. So, yeah, it's true. I don't know. I'm blaming Tristan for this. It's not me.
Completely fair. Completely
it really
fair,
makes no sense to me how I said this last week that the child who can be embarrassed if you're driving along the street and somebody could hear the music playing in your car would not make any sort of public display of emotion whatsoever, gets on the baseball field, and all of a sudden he's out there screaming at the umpire and making these dramatic motions. I'm just like, what is it about sport that is, at least I'm like pretty over the top in a lot of other situations.
I do remember you kicking a garbage can.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm over the top in other situations beyond just professional sport. If it's sunny outside, I'm going to put on Vince Staples as loud as possible and try to have people around me hear it. But for him, it's only on the baseball diamond.
Look, some people, you know, you just get between those lines. You turn it on and then it comes off as soon as you step outside of them. So apparently Luca is one of those people.
Well, he did step outside of those lines this week.
Oh, no. Oh no. Well, it's been another classic Coach's Corner. So thanks so much to Mrs. Fantasy Genius for joining us this week.
Anytime.
As long as the children are unruly.
Did you have any thoughts on that Coach's Corner, Katie?
It's a great Coach's Corner. I related a lot to it because I watched an inning of baseball today, of Little League. What was it? I don't know. Children's baseball. And why do they let these children pitch?
I mean, they have to start somewhere, I guess.
It was so terrible. I'm so not in the children's softball baseball world, and I didn't know that they let these like 9-10-year-olds pitch that really can't. And so every throw that I watched hit the ground. Every pitch hit the ground. And it was just like everybody walked. And then they also, like Kayleen was saying, they let them do steals. And I was like, why are they letting these kids do steals? Because basically there's no fielding. There's nothing. It's just walking and then stealing, walking and then stealing. It's like, that's not really baseball, but whatever.
I mean, baseball might be a little more exciting if there was that much stealing, probably not if there were that much walking. So no M's hot takes this week, but we do have, I have decreed this. My Jay Leno style Mariners joke.
Oh my God.
Oh dear. Can I leave now?
So you see in the news story that Mariners are now allowing you, if you're vaccinated, no masks in T-Mobile Park. Yeah, you know, CDC guidance, I guess, you know, that makes sense. Didn't get as much attention as the other news story. Mariners said, if you're a pitcher who's vaccinated, no hits in T-Mobile Park. Yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe if you're unvaccinated, I don't know, can I get any hits?
I didn't know you were going to do it in the Jay Leno voice.
Oh, yeah. You gotta do that.
Oh. You should have worn denim.
I did consider referencing. You see that new story, Bradford?
You're going all the way back to Bradford Marsalis.
Yes. Kevin Eubanks, was that the second guy? I can't remember the name for sure. It's been a very long time since I've watched Jay Leno.
Straight back to like 1993.
I mean, that's, well, I don't know if it was that long ago. That's when I was the peak of when was actually watching The Tonight Show. So.
Great joke.
Thanks. So the Mariners got no hit for the second time in this season, both at home. This is incredible.
They basically got no hit for this entire Tigers series. There was one exciting Kelenic game.
Yes.
We had, that was last Friday night, right?
Where it was Kelenic, the second game, yeah,
homered and hit two doubles. And it was just like, let's fucking go. It is on. Jared Kelenic is going to be so exciting. And then this Tigers series happened.
And then we remember that, like, in baseball, you could have Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani. You could have maybe the two best players in all of baseball, perhaps, and still be really shitty because baseball is so poorly designed that one player doesn't matter at all. It's a bad sport.
Sport is poorly designed.
It is. That's a bad way to have a sport.
Oh, that's a hot take. Don't you think
you don't agree with that? You don't think that baseball is poorly designed for 2021?
Couldn't you make it less poorly designed?
Sure. Like if you got to come up to hit more than once, you know, every nine at bats, if you got to hit like once an inning, it would be more exciting.
Didn't the Mariners choose to make their park more of a pitcher's park than a...
Well, I mean, are we lauding the Mariners for their decision-making at this or any other point?
I'm just saying, like, there's choices that could have been made.
Mistakes were made.
Yeah.
For this or any other point.
Look, so...
I love your idea that a well-designed sport is a sport where one individual player should make so much of an impact on the game that it makes your team good. Basically, what you're talking about is basketball.
Like LeBron, am I right?
I mean, not necessarily. Like,
guide you straight to the seven seed.
Baseball is increasingly unpopular. This is not like a surprising take.
But also football, like the Texans can have Deshaun Watson and still be a terrible team.
Yeah, that's not quite the same. Deshaun Watson is not as good as Mike Trout. No one as good as Mike Trout would be on a bad team in football. It's just not possible. And like
Drew
a perennially
for
bad
a
team.
Of years.
They were like a 500 team for a few years. But again, I'm like Mike Trout's when was the last time the Angels made the playoffs? It's been a very long time, right? And he's like historically good in that. And that's a problem. And also Mike Trout, like no one knows who Mike Trout is.
Yeah, we've already talked too long about baseball.
We have. Let's talk instead about the Sounders. You got a 2-0 win on Sunday versus LAFC, running their best start in franchise history to 5-0-1, 16 points through their first six matches. So the Sounders played without Stephen Fry, their starting goalkeeper, who has a knee sprain, according to Brian Schmetzer, presumably a grade 2 based on the timeline of 4 to 6 weeks for his return. Backup Stephen Cleveland stepped in because the Sounders have to have someone named Stephen keeping goal for them. For just his sixth...
Really is like UW with Jakes.
Yes. For just his sixth MLS career start and helped the Sounders survive major LAFC possession advantage in the first half and get to the break scoreless. Sounders took the upper hand in the second half and got a Javier Arriaga header in the 57th minute for his first MLS goal to break the scoreless draw. The unstoppable Brad Smith doubled the lead with a headed goal in the 73rd minute on the break. And despite Carlos Vela returning for LAFC as a sub for the last 20 minutes, the Sounders kept a clean sheet for the fourth time in their six games so far this season. Sounders now 4 points clear of anyone else in MLS, though the LA Galaxy do still have a match in hand on them. The injury news not as good on midfielder / defender Jordy Delem, who suffered an ACL tear in that win at San Jose and is out for the season. Nico Ladero, also we got the news that he is not expected to play until June due to ongoing pain and inflammation in his right knee, according to Brian Schmetz. And Sanders have a couple week break at the start of June, and maybe after that we'll see him again.
Katie, your thoughts?
I saw a picture on Twitter of the new goalie looking like John Ryan. That's my thought.
Well, there you go.
He punted the ball. No, when he faked the punt. Whatever. You know what I'm talking about. The awkward John Ryan.
I see. Yes. In the NFC, or no, the when he got tackled against the Rams. No, or the NFC Championship game when he threw the touchdown. Yeah, the NFC Championship.
Yeah. That's my impact.
Dynamite drop in.
Look, Katie said she knew nothing about Seattle sports right now. Okay. It's another national TV matchup for the Sounders this weekend with the two recent MLS Cup winners against Atlanta United FC. Atlanta slipped badly in 2020 after MLS leading scorer Joseph Martinez had an ACL tear in the season opener, missing the expanded playoffs in the East. They are tied for third in the East so far this season, with Martinez starting twice thus far and scoring once.
Quickly on the Sounders, though, but before we move on, this hot start that they've had, if I am to understand anything about the Sounders, they can either, I'll say, start hot or finish hot. They cannot do both.
I mean, right? there was one season that they won the Supporters' Shield.
But our anticipation cannot be that they've started hot. I understand the season is a little bit shorter, but we can't approach this. It's nice to be good, but the expectation has to be they're going to get bad at some point and then maybe get good again throughout the season, but they cannot be good for an entire season.
It's a long season. Raul Diaz will miss some time at some point, you know, to join his national team. But so far, the big thing is takeaway is that the 3-5-2 formation that they shifted to this year has been impenetrable defensively. They have not conceded a goal from open play yet. Both of the goals they've allowed have been off set pieces.
In how many matches?
6 matches.
Wow.
So, that's pretty effing awesome. And it's they've just been playing it for 6 games. So you'd think they'd get better and more cohesive, although maybe teams figure out a better way to attack it. But it's not like no one has ever played a 3-5-2 in MLS before. So it's pretty impressive. And to do it again with Lodero playing very limited role, if that. Let's go to the OL Reign, who opened the NWSL campaign on Saturday with a scoreless draw against the North Carolina Courage. Megan Rapinoe came off the bench in that one, playing the final 33 minutes. This Saturday, the Reign headed to Portland to take on the Thorns in a game that will be on CBS Sports at 4 p.m. Portland looks like the class of the NWSL so far. They won the Challenge Cup on PKs after drawing 1-1 with Gotham FC in the final at Providence Park, and then crushed Chicago 5-0 in their regular season opener last weekend. Good news for the Reign, though, is that Rose Lavelle is officially on the way. She will join the team for training next Wednesday and be available for the following match. The bronze ball winner in the 2019 World Cup, Lavelle gives the Reign 2 of the 3 leading scorers in that competition, along with golden ball winner Megan Rapinoe. And Lavelle scored, you'll recall, in the final win for the U.S. Women's National Team against the Netherlands in the 2019 World Cup. So big time addition for the Reign on the way. Seattle Storm also opened their regular season on Saturday. And after getting their championship rings, unveiling the new banner in the rafters of Angel of the Winds Arena in Everett, with now 4 championships on there, 2004, 2010, 2018, and 2020. They then went and looked a lot like the championship team on Saturday, beating their opponent in the finals and probably the favorite in the WNBA this year, the Las Vegas Aces, 97-83. With a really impressive complete performance in that one. Things did not go as well in the rematch between those two teams on Tuesday night, also on national TV, where Las Vegas came up with the 96-80 win to even the series between the two teams. Vegas really shot the ball well from 3 in that game on Tuesday, and the Storm were not nearly as sharp offensively. Didn't get much from their bench. It was pretty much just Jewel Lloyd and Brianna Stewart making things happen offensively for the Storm in that one. So it was kind of the fear you had, I guess, about the team this year after their offseason changes. One exciting development has been the play of Ezzie Magbegor through two games. She started the second half to match up on Saturday with Liz Cambage, her teammate on the Australian national team, and then got her first career WNBA start on Tuesday and had a double-double in that one. So Magbegor, you know, making the case for more playing time, although the Storm will have more options at center with Mercedes Russell expected to be available for her first game on Thursday after coming back from playing in the Turkish finals, along with Epiphany Prince, who should also be in the rotation for that game. And then the Storm losing starting small forward Kitty Lou Samuelson, who after these first two games and played quite well on Tuesday with 13 points, made a buzzer beating three from around half court to end the third quarter, but she's headed overseas to play in the for the USA basketball 3x3 team in the Olympic qualifying tournament, which will take place next week in Austria. So that's a thing that happens. Storm busy week. We'll take on Minnesota Thursday on the road, Saturday at Dallas, and then back home Tuesday to take on the Connecticut Sun.
This is like a 3-on-3 team, like Nike Hoop Summit style, right? She's going to Spokane for this.
She's not. I mean, it's an Olympic sport now. Like, they're going to give out a gold medal for 3-on-3 basketball. It's sort of the idea is it's like FIBA, which runs world basketball, wants it to be like volleyball, where you've got the beach volleyball and you've got the indoor and you get two separate gold medals. So more basketball in the Olympics. And the 3x3 team is not the very best players in the U.S. There's several good players on the U.S. team. Kelsey Plum, who made her return from her Achilles injury over the weekend in Seattle. She's also going to be part of this team. And Satu Savali from Oregon, the number 2 pick in last year's WNBA draft. So some quality players on this team, but kind of tough with the timing of the qualifying tournament.
How's Kelsey Plum playing, by the way?
Didn't make much of an impact in the opener, but was very good off the bench in game 2. She was one of the reasons Las Vegas played so much better in that second game. Let's move on to UW softball. It was a disappointing finish to the Pac-12 schedule for the Huskies, who dropped 2 of 4 at Stanford, including just the second loss of the season on Friday for Gabby Plain when she went the distance in a 4-1 loss. Plain did throw complete game shutouts Thursday and Saturday, running her record to 29-2 this season.
A disappointing 29-2.
Yeah, could have been better. Huskies got run ruled in 5 innings in the non-conference second game on Friday and managed just 6 total runs in the 4 games, but still finished second in the Pac-12 at 18-5, 2 games back of 19-2 UCLA, and 4.5 games ahead of 14-10 Oregon, which made it all the more shocking when on Sunday we got the word from the NCAA softball selection committee, that the Huskies, who are ranked 6th in the ESPN poll, are the number 16 seed in the NCAA tournament.
The disgrace. I know nothing about this right now, but I saw the seed and I was upset.
So it's time for, we haven't done this in a while, we're going to air some fucking grievances. Yes! With the NCAA tournament selection committee.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now you're going to hear about it.
So, why did this happen, you ask? How the fuck could a team that was ranked 6th in the country end up with the 16th seed in a situation where, if they win the regional that they're hosting next weekend, they have to play at number 1 seeded Oklahoma the following weekend? Which is like not enough that Oklahoma already gets to host the Women's College World Series every year. They've got to, you know, get this advantage as well. So, the reason, of course, is a thing that we finally got rid of in college basketball, the godforsaken RPI. So the Huskies rank 16th in RPI. So it's not a coincidence that they finished 16th as the seed. If you look at this statistically, the correlation between where teams ranked in RPI and their seed, it explains about 80% of what the selection committee did. So this is good because RPI is a great metric, right? No, of course, RPI sucks. If you look at an actual advanced stat, the Massey ratings for women's college softball, similar, you know, more famous Massey, I think was part of the statistical formula that were used in the BCS back in the day to pick those college football teams. their correlation between that and the seed in the NCAA tournament only explains about a quarter of it. The Huskies were seventh in the Massey ratings. And you'll never guess which conference got wildly underseeded compared to Massey ratings. It was the Pac-12. I don't know if we wanted an awkward silence there. Arizona State ranked ninth in the Massey ratings. They got the 15th seed. Arizona is ranked fourth. They got the 11th seed. Oregon is up there and didn't get seeded at all. And somehow the ESPN college softball rankings, USA softball rankings, managed to actually align very closely with the statistical rankings and yet completely disregarded by the selection committee. And you'll never guess again, which conference do you think got wildly overrated by the selection committee relative to the statistical ratings and the polls?
Is it the SEC?
Of course it's the fucking SEC. LSU got the 7th seed. They're 17th in the Massey ratings. Tennessee got the 9th seed. They're 20th in the Massey ratings. And even Kentucky, which is 18th in the Massey ratings and 18th in the RPI. They are behind UW in the RPI. Even the flawed fucking metric you were using to select this bullshit, they were behind UW in, and yet still got a higher seed with the 14th seed. So get your shit together, NCAA selection committee. Stop favoring the SEC in every sport. It does not matter more to the SEC in softball. The Pac-12 softball matters more.
There we go. This is fucking bullshit. Who's even on this committee? Condoleezza Rice? What other war criminals are on this committee choosing teams for the Pac-12 or for the women's softball tournament? How is this happening? How is this continuing to happen? What?
I do not know the identities of the selection
committee. In the year 2021, how is this still continuing to happen? I get it in football. I understand in football why this would happen. In softball, though, that's our sport. That's the Pac-12 sport. How can you have a bad RPI and be in the conference where every single team is good at softball?
I don't really understand. I mean, obviously the RPI is probably more flawed than usual this season because there wasn't a lot of intra-conference competition, but or interconference competition, I should say, but you know, somehow the Massey ratings managed to detect it and figure it out. And again, the pollsters, they generally got it right.
God, yet, I want to see Gabby Plank go in there and fucking sweep Oklahoma, take them out, and be like, I'm the captain now. We're the number one seed.
If you beat the number one seed, you become the number one seed, as you like to say. So the Huskies this weekend in the regional will host Michigan, Portland State, and Seattle U starting on Friday. Michigan, the real threat there. They're number 32 in the Massey ratings. Seattle U and Portland State, which are both automatic qualifiers from the Northwest, ranked 113th and 232nd, respectively. The Huskies will open against the Vikings on Friday in the double elimination format the NCAA tournament uses for the regionals.
Was that the segment, the new segment that you were saying?
Yes, that was the surprise segment.
The airing of
grievances. Where we're going to mix it up.
A surprise airing of grievances. Can we talk about the new Pac-12 commissioner? Do we have any thoughts here? Katie, do you have thoughts on this person? What is the chatter on the internet?
I have no idea who this person is. I've not been paying attention to any sport, except for UW basketball a little bit. But I don't even know who this person is. I don't.
So he was an executive at MGM, and the thinking here is that, you know, a lot of the decision here by the Pac-12 presidents, whatever they call it, the executive committee or whatever they call it, was based on the upcoming rights deal and making sure that they can maximize that deal.
So this is who John Wilner said that he was like just shocked, completely shocked by, that he couldn't believe it. He had to check his source twice. Or four times, he said.
Yeah, I mean, certainly George Klyavkov was not a name that was familiar to people in college sports. I mean, you know, usually these commissioners come from like they're a president, you know, they're an athletic director at a school. So this is definitely a different direction to go with this decision.
Is that a bad thing, though?
Not necessarily. I mean, Larry Scott was also outside of that realm. He came from... Yeah, I think tennis. A tennis tour. Yeah. Klyavkov was the president of entertainment and sports at MGM Resorts. I think the one thing that was a real red flag was he was asked a question about I want to say it was about women's basketball and its role, and said that our priority is men's basketball and football, which, like, I get that those probably are the priorities from a revenue standpoint, but you don't say that, especially in response to a question about women's sports.
It's like fucking Mariners, dude.
Yes, Kevin Mather.
Yeah. It's like, you lie. Don't you understand when you're talking to the press?
Yes.
Unless you're in the SEC, in which case you just say whatever the fuck you want. No one cares.
He did apparently serve as a member of the board of governors for the WNBA when the MGM previously owned the Las Vegas Aces, which were sold to Mark Davis last year, which, by the way, I saw Mark Davis coming into the arena on Saturday.
There we go.
Yeah, there's your celebrity sighting.
I didn't know Mark Davis socially was distanced the owner game. Of the Aces.
He purchased them this offseason, yes.
That's pretty cool. Look at Mark Davis. I like it. All right, fuck it. I'll cheer for the Raiders.
If you're forcing me.
He's on. They're on Russ's list. It'll be a natural transition.
Oh no. So yeah, that's basically it. I mean, it's kind of wait and see, I guess. Like, anyone who has a strong take about this decision from the Pac-12 is probably wrong,
or thinks that a new commissioner can completely transform the, like, future of the Pac-12.
Right. And the other thing is, like, the things that people complain about is about the Pac-12. Like, oh, the games are on late, but they're also not televised widely enough. It's like, well, that's just the reality of being on the West Coast. I hate to break it to you. Unless you want to move the Pac-12 to the East, or, like, add teams from, you know, the Eastern Seaboard to the Pac-12, you're going to have bad TV deals. Like, that's just the situation. So
I would still be all about Texas joining the Pac-12.
I mean, I like that plan to the extent that it actually made the Pac-12 back into kind of the Pacific Coast Conference, because you'd probably play primarily against the 8 teams that would be in the, you know, the one conference or the one division of the conference. And then it's kind of sucks for Arizona and Arizona State, because they would get shunted off with Colorado, Utah into that Eastern division.
That also would have Texas and Texas whatever, Texas Tech or somebody,
and Oklahoma and Oklahoma State, yeah, under that proposal.
Would be a very good conference.
It would be, yeah. But I mean, to me, the main thing is to, like, compete against the other schools from the West Coast. So if you actually did, like, if you played all 7 of the other schools on the West Coast every year, that to me would be preferable than having Colorado and Utah and Arizona State in the mix.
Would Arizona care the same way that you do, though,
about being part of that group?
Yeah, they probably don't care as much about playing the West Coast schools, maybe.
Probably not. It's not as long of a tradition. I mean, obviously, they were the two newest members of the Pac-10 before the expansion to 12. And, you know, it's the core group of 8 goes back to, like, the early 1900s. So there is a longer tradition of the Oregon schools, the Washington schools, and the California schools.
And also culturally are not that far off from, say, Texas or Oklahoma.
Arizona?
Yeah.
I don't know. The last election suggests otherwise.
Maricopa County.
Hey, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen.
We don't.
On and on.
The last election would suggest otherwise. Also, the location that Austin is probably very, very similar to St. Louis.
Wow. It's actually probably much more similar to the Bay Area, I would say. It's probably most similar to Palo Alto in Seattle, Austin.
I think you've gone too far. unless you go a single mile outside of town.
Yeah. You just got to stay within the city limits. That's why they call it Austin City Limits.
In any direction.
Should we talk about UW men's basketball? Which has added yet another transfer. And not one from upstate New York, not one even from New Hampshire or wherever, Nashua.
Nashua.
Yeah.
Binghamton.
Another one from the Seattle area, and that's former TCU shooting guard PJ Fuller announcing his transfer to UW. Fuller played at both Garfield and Nathan Hale, winning state championships at both schools while playing for Brandon Roy before transferring to Findlay Prep in Las Vegas for his senior year. A 4-star recruit by ESPN Recruiting Nation, Fuller spent 2 years at TCU, starting 18 games last season, but averaging just 5.8 points per game. Development as a shooter, I think, will be key to his success at UW. He's hit just 28% of his threes over the two seasons at TCU, but 77% of his free throws, which is more promising. And the 500 true shooting percentage he posted last year is a dramatic upgrade on Eric Stevenson's 460 mark. So 3 years of remaining eligibility for Fuller after this transfer.
It's exciting to see a lot of names that I was kind of hoping we would get or go for a few years ago coming back. So
absolutely. I mean, Fuller was a big time recruit at that point, someone that would have been very important for UW.
Yeah.
And still is, I suppose, certainly.
I think I saw today though that didn't Hopkins offer a former Syracuse player? Is that a recent thing?
I have not seen that report. I heard Marjon Beauchamp is a candidate for the last remaining scholarship that they have available.
I was going to say Tristan might get his wish of us getting more New York players.
He just enjoys making jokes about it. I think it kind of is your wish, though.
Yeah.
Like, I wish for the Mariners to get no hit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're going to lose, you might as well get no hit.
It really was quite shocking when I saw it. Like, I happened to be watching SportsCenter. You know, flip on SportsCenter, and the first thing I see is like the last out of the Mariners no-hitter.
Oh yeah, they were like six innings in, and I was like, oh, the Mariners, like there was a walk or something. It didn't feel like they were getting no hit, and I was like, oh, I think the Mariners are getting no hit. And then I checked, I got a notification later that they'd pulled it off. Just like nice one. It doesn't really feel that dramatic, but UW, just a lot of players in the mix, and a lot of players who seem like they can be competent Pac-12 basketball players, which feels pretty different than the team that was assembled for last season.
I mean, we had hope about what was going to be, you know, whether they were going to be competent last season. But yeah, I mean, especially compared to where we were when like half the team had transferred after, you know, this dreadful season, things feel a lot more optimistic now. And Fuller, I think one thing that makes him a little different than the other transfers they've added who've come back, you know, Emmett Matthews Jr., Terrell Brown Jr., Dejon Davis, is those guys, I think, have at most 2 years of eligibility. So Fuller is, you know, hypothetically someone who could be part of this program for several years to come. So
I'd cool off on that.
I think the rule is you only get the free transfer one time. And now if you transfer again, you do have to sit out a season. But I'm not, sure on that. They're just trying to get you hooked on transfers.
who was the last player that you were saying? Rodrigue? Jordan Beauchamp?
Marjon Beauchamp.
Marjon, there we go. We got there. Marjon Beauchamp was the player that you'd heard. What's their deal?
Beauchamp had originally planned to declare for the NBA draft this year, but then decided to reconsider that decision.
From where?
He's someone who I think played at Garfield as well at one point. Currently playing at Yakima Valley College, I guess.
Oh, interesting. So it would be a transfer from junior college.
Yes. And someone I've seen play in the Jamal Crawford crossover pro-am. You know, it was him and Paolo Banchero were the two high school players, I think, that were notably playing a few years ago.
How did they fare?
Beauchamp was not nearly as effective as Banchero, which makes sense because Banchero is now, like, we have him at ESPN, our draft experts have him as the number one pick the number two pick, I guess. I think he still might be behind Chet Holmgren, but it's either him or Holmgren is the number one pick in 2022. So,
Chet Holmgren white?
Chet Holmgren is white, yes.
Wow, white boy summer indeed.
Yes, and really what a come up for the Minneapolis basketball community to have Paige Beckers on the women's side, Jalen Suggs, and Chet Holmgren all within a span of a couple of years here. So,
is Chet Gonzaga?
Yes, he is, yes.
Wait, that. What?
He's going to Gonzaga, yes.
Chet Holmgren is too?
He sure is.
God, of course.
So.
Mm.
Yeah.
Cool.
Looking forward to that visit to Spokane this year.
So the thing about the Huskies is they have put together a lot of guys
yep.
that would get better if they are developed. go through development, usually with a coach that could develop, or maybe they just do that intrinsically. But I don't know if the track record is there for that to be occurring.
Yeah, I mean, we had these same high hopes about Eric Stevenson last year when he was transferring to UW from Wichita State, and his free throw shooting numbers suggested that, you know, there may be some 3-point improvement in the offing, and then that didn't necessarily materialize last season. I mean, I Dejon Davis and Emmett Mathis Jr. and Terrell Brown Jr., those guys are coming in as, you'd like to see some improvement from them as shooters, because that's the one thing about all these guys that UW has added. None of them shooting is the number one strength for any of these guys. But, you know, those are polished college players. And even Fuller, again, has been starting at a major conference level. So, you know, there's certainly value there. But yes, a stronger emphasis on player development would be an important thing for the Huskies. And now the one thing is, the coaching staff is very different than it was last season, because you've got Wyking Jones and Quincy Pondexter now in the mix. So we'll see. But again,
Katie gives that an awkward silence.
Oh, an MVP then.
Is Katie frozen?
I think she is, in fact, frozen.
Okay. That's the ultimate awkward silence. Freezing on Zoom.
A very fitting conclusion to this podcast.
The coaching staff is a different coaching staff, you know? And I think the anticipation... Bye, Katie. Thanks for joining us. Give the podcast my regards, Katie says. Oh, truly MVP performance. It's a different coaching staff. I don't know if I would necessarily say that Mike Hopkins has been bad at developing players. I think there's been a severe lack of talent on the team, but like, players have developed. I mean, obviously Matisse is somebody who developed under Mike Hopkins. Like,
I mean,
if you're able to the idea of quote unquote development and being able to develop players is, I think it's kind of a myth. And the amount of coaches in all of college basketball who can do it in that short of a time period, take players who are maybe not the highest talent players and make them into talented players.
I think of a coach who was historically pretty good at developing players, especially those who stuck around for 4 years.
But that, you need a lot of time for that. How many players has Mike Hopkins had stick around for 4 years? Like, it is a different college basketball than Lorenzo Romo was in. You're talking about a unicorn right now.
Or it's fair that, like, a Quincy Pondexter situation. But, like, Terrence Ross wasn't a highly regarded recruit, and he developed pretty dramatically from year to one to year two.
Pretty highly regarded recruit.
He wasn't nearly as highly regarded as Terrence Jones. And guess what? He went in the lottery, and Terrence Jones didn't. Or Terrence Jones might have, but he went higher.
I don't exactly think that's a great point, but
I mean, Terrence Ross was not that big a recruit. Oh, you're misremembering this.
One player developing from 1 year to the next does not mean
he's not the only example. I mean, yes, I'm talking about an example
of developing players. You're talking about people who are the greatest college basketball. You either have a scheme or whatever. Like, I just don't know if I even believe in the concept of coaches developing players.
I mean, at the NBA level, there's not a lot of evidence that coaches develop players differently than other coaches, that it's statistically significant. But I think that's different at the college level, where the differences among coaches are much greater.
Both a combination of an ability to keep players around for a long period of time, the right amount of talent.
You're too focused on this. Like, players can develop in 1 year. Like Marquise Chris. That's an example of a guy who was a completely unheralded recruit. Nobody thought was going to be a one and done. Yeah, he got better.
Okay.
I don't know how that's in dispute.
That much better in one season, I think there has to be a lot of credit for the player. And
sure, and probably to some extent, he was just underrated as a prospect.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
but that doesn't mean there wasn't development. The idea that you can only develop if you're there for 5 years is a preposterous notion.
Mike Hopkins, I'm saying that I don't think we should just assume that Mike Hopkins is bad at developing players. I don't know if he's really even had the opportunity to do so.
I think he's had a lot of opportunities to do so, and they have not worked out. I mean, you know, Hamir Wright, you go back to his complaints about, I don't think that Hamir Wright was someone who should have been playing a larger role in the offense, but was Hamir Wright any better last season than he was as a freshman? He was basically the same player.
There were Romar players who
didn't really
develop over time. Like
every individual player is unique. You need to build up a sample size. But what is the example of a development success story under Mike Hopkins?
You don't think Thybulle is?
No. Mike Hopkins' defense was perfect for Matisse Thybulle, but Matisse Thybulle on the first day of his junior year was basically the same player he was on the last day of his senior year.
All right.
So. And was underrated previously under Lorenzo Romar when it was evident to me that he was going to be a good NBA prospect. Shouts to that. The tweet about him being a better prospect than DeJounte Murray did not necessarily age well, but it didn't age poorly either.
Has DeJounte played that well?
He played quite well in the play-in loss today.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Again, your sample size is a single game.
He's been better than Matisse Thybulle this year, despite the fact that Matisse Thybulle is going to get a lot of all defensive picks and not just from me.
ESPN's Kevin Pelton doesn't understand sample size. Are we going to preview the Blazers at all? Are we going to talk about the Blazers? Are we going to wait until after this weekend?
We can talk about the Blazers.
Now that Katie's gone.
I think she was preventing us from talking about the Blazers. So they're facing Denver in the first round. I think things broke very well for the Blazers with, first off, them avoiding the play-in. A thing that's bugging me is a lot of people are talking about like Denver just laid down for the Blazers on the last day of the season, and that's not the case. They played all their starters, and the reason they didn't play them more is because the Blazers blitzed them out of the gate. They went like... They did like 5 threes in the first 2 minutes of the game. And I was like, all right, I guess I'm not watching this one anymore because it's not a competitive game. Like Denver might have tried if it were a legitimate game, but it wasn't. Portland just ended it immediately. And that's kind of the goal.
Okay, so now a rematch in the playoffs. How do you think the Blazers stack up against a team like Denver?
I think it's an ideal matchup from the standpoint that all of Denver's guards are injured. Not quite. Facundo Campazzo is healthy.
There we go.
Monte Morris is on a minutes limit, just came back for the last two games of the regular season. Will Barton got hurt. Obviously, Jamal Murray. PJ Dozier, who was starting for them, got injured. And it's unclear whether Barton and Dozier are going to play in this series. I'd feel a lot better about making my pick if I knew what to expect from them. But Austin Rivers has been starting at shooting guard for Denver, who was picked up after he was waived midseason. Which is, I think, the second time that the Blazers have played Austin Rivers in a key role in a playoff series, going back to 2016 with the Clippers.
That was the series that they won when everybody got hurt, right? Yeah.
Correct. And Austin Rivers played a lot in that series after Chris Paul and Blake Griffin got hurt and played reasonably well, but was asked to do a bit too much. So, you know, how are you going to match up with both Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum if you don't have, you know, your primary defenders on the perimeter is a major question mark about Denver. I think how the Blazers match up with Jokic and Michael Porter Jr. Like Michael Porter Jr. is going to be a problem in this series because, you know, the Blazers don't have a lot of size. Covington, I guess.
I feel like that Roko's like kind of the perfect player to defend. But
Covington's only 6'7". Porter is going to be able to shoot over the top of him.
They're okay. How many teams in the league have a player who can defend somebody?
But also, if
Jokic and MPJ,
if you've got Covington defending, you've enumerated why the Nuggets have stayed good after the Jamal Murray injury. If you've got Covington defending Michael Porter Jr., that means Norm Powell is defending Aaron Gordon. Like you're gonna have a major size mismatch at one of the two forward spots.
Can Aaron Gordon shoot though?
He can shoot enough.
Interesting.
I mean, I think he might be able to mash Powell on the offensive glass would be the concern in this series.
And what are you picking in this series? You do picks for every playoff series.
Well, reluctantly, because I've been wrong every single time I've picked the Blazers in a playoff series in the 13 seasons now I've been going to games in Portland.
No, I don't believe this to be true. You've picked the Blazers to win a playoff series before? To make the playoffs?
I picked them in 2009 over Houston. I picked them in 2010 over Phoenix. I picked them in 2011 over Dallas. And then I picked them in 17 over New Orleans. And they have lost all of those series.
Wow. God.
And all of the series, therefore, they've won, which are a few of them. The two to get to the conference finals 2 years ago, and then also beating Houston in the first round in 14. All of those, I have picked the Blazers to lose.
Damn you. It's over.
So, yes, I picked the Blazers in six.
RIP.
But it's going to be a fun series. I mean, Jokic is going to be the MVP. Dame, a rematch of that 2019 series.
You just told me it was
Nuggets
in four, though.
I don't think it's going to be Nuggets in four.
After you said the same thing about New Orleans.
I mean, if they played that New Orleans series again, I still don't think it would be New Orleans in four. The shot making and the numbers in that series were outrageous.
Rondo's still getting paid for that series.
No, I think it's also from the championship he won last year. Probably from that too.
Well, I'm excited for playoff basketball to be back, for it to feel a little bit like normal. We're heading in this time period. It's a little bit later than it would normally be.
Yeah, it's much normal. These series are going into June. There's going to be June basketball. Like, you normally you only get that if you play in the NBA Finals.
But it feels it feels like the NBA playoffs now. You know, like there's fans in most of these arenas and it doesn't feel unsafe. I mean, I even thought about, you're heading down to Portland for game three.
I probably will not go to game three because of the timing of that one, but would anticipate I will go to game four on Saturday, the 29th.
I definitely considered, floated the idea mentally of heading to a Blazers playoff game. I assume they're still at pretty low capacity. They're actually at less capacity than Ravensdale Park for these Blazers games.
No. Oh, no. Yeah, it's very difficult to get tickets.
A lot more masks, too.
That is undoubtedly true. And it was good to see the vaccinated section at Angel of the Winds Arena on Saturday and everyone wearing masks. And it did not feel unsafe, I would say, in the arena at all.
I'm going to my first sporting event post pandemic. I don't know when you declare the pandemic over, but it's not. But I'm going to my first
start of the pandemic.
Yeah, I started the pandemic with a sporting event back in like February 27th against Olympia or whatever they were called, right?
Yes.
And we'll pick it back up with a Sounders match on Sunday.
There you go.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, okay.
15 months later.
Yeah, I had the UW men's basketball game the night after that. So I had two sporting events in Seattle, plus the Celtics game I attended the following week to kick off that pandemic.
That was a terrible decision.
It really was. But, you know, there have been a lot of those on this podcast.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.